Welcome to the Cancer Research UK Cambridge Centre podcast. The Cancer Research UK Cambridge Centre unites over 1,200 world-leading biologists, chemists, physicists, engineers, mathematicians, computer scientists, clinicians, nurses, and allied healthcare professionals from across Cambridge in the UK to tackle cancer from every angle. Our mission is to end death and disease caused by cancer through research, treatment, and education. We are detecting cancer at its earliest stage and are developing personalized treatments for every patient through facilitating new collaborations and driving the translation of new scientific discoveries into clinical applications to improve patient care. By working together across a range of different disciplines, our members are breaking down the barriers between the laboratory and the clinic, enabling patients to benefit from the very latest innovations in cancer research. In this special episode of our podcast, we are bringing you the recording of a live Ask Me Anything event. It was held by the Pancreatic Cancer Program on the World Pancreatic Cancer Day on the 16th of November this year. This AMS session saw specialists across different disciplines answering questions submitted by the members of public and discussing topics related to day-by-day living with pancreatic cancer. Now I'll hand over to Dr. Bristy Basu, the co-lead of the Pancreatic Cancer Program, to get the event started, and hope you enjoy the event.
Hello everybody, I'm Bristy Basu. I'm the co-lead of the Cambridge Cancer Centre Pancreatic Programme. And it's a delight to welcome so many wonderful panelists to join me on this webinar. We do an annual webinar on World Pancreatic Cancer Day, 16th of November this year. And why are we here? Well, we know that pancreatic cancer is a cancer of such high unmet need. And our focus today is not on the difficulties and the challenges, but actually how we can overcome them living day by day with pancreatic cancer, because we want to make sure that people aren't focusing on the negatives. And so we, based on our previous Ask Me Anything webinars, we elected to kind of choose topics where we felt that we might be able to focus on aspects where there've been helpful inputs and what people have learned, which can make them help better to live better, have a better quality of life living day by day with their pancreatic cancer. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my co-host for this webinar, who is our fantastic PPI rep, Sally. Sally, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Sally Pascal. I'm a 12-year pancreatic cancer survivor. And as Bristy has just said, I'm a PPI representative, that's patient and public involvement representative on the Cambridge Pancreatic Cancer Programme.
Great. So I'm going to introduce a few of the other members of our team. We've got Jenny here.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Jenny Jones. I am pancreatic cancer specialist nurse working at Pancreatic Cancer UK.
Asif.
Morning, everyone. Warm welcome to everyone. I'm Asif Jah. I'm a pancreatic surgeon, hepatobiliary surgeon at Cambridge and Brooks Hospital.
Yvonne.
Hello, I'm Yvonne Cartwright. I'm a palliative medicine consultant, but I'm also the medical lead for Enhanced Supportive Care, which delivers supportive care alongside active cancer treatment within Adam Brooks.
Laura.
Good morning. My name's Laura McGeady. I'm a pancreatic cancer dietitian here in Cambridge. So me and my team, we help to support people's nutrition anywhere along the pancreatic cancer pathway.
Thank you. Abby.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. So I'm Abby. I'm the pancreatic cancer and also liver cancer nurse specialist here at Adam Brooks. So my role is to support patients from their diagnosis throughout treatment and for their journey with pancreatic cancer. Thank you.
Kirsty.
Morning. Thank you for having me. My name's Kirsty, and I'm a cancer support specialist with Maggie's in Cambridge, and I help to support patients and their families emotionally and psychologically. Thank you.
And we're delighted to invite Paulo, a guest from Portugal, just to highlight that this is an international effort, you know, to try and improve outcomes for our patients with pancreatic cancer. Paulo, would you mind just introducing yourself?
Well, I'm Paulo Fidalgo. I'm a gastroenterologist. I'm mainly related to risk assessment of pancreatic cancer, and I'm working on surveillance of high-risk groups like family, pancreatic cancer aggregation, monogenic diseases, and surveillance of descendants. And I'm related also to the CIST, the pancreatic CIST program surveillance. And my role is to advise family members at risk.
Thank you very much. And the reason that we invited Paulo is because it is a common question. Although the bulk of our webinar will be dealing with symptoms and managing symptoms and quality of life and aspects of living day-to-day with pancreatic cancer, there were some questions coming to us already about how we detect this earlier and how we might be able to kind of identify patients earlier in their pathway so that they can have a better outcome overall. So we invited Paulo specifically for that. And just to highlight again, this is an international effort. We've had colleagues from Australia who've already joined and done other events for World Pancreatic Cancer Day. But without further ado, I'm going to ask Sally to take over the reins, and I will be joining and doing the technical aspects. Just to mention to the audience, if you have any questions, could you please submit them via the question and answer rather than via the chat? Please don't use the chat function. If you submit them to the question and answer, and we will answer what we can either during the webinar or in the chat. Thank you.
Right, so off we go. As we've already said, I'm in the hugely privileged and very unexpected position of being a long-term cancer survivor. 12 years ago, there seemed to be fairly limited resources to find out information and access to treatments and so on. Jenny and Kirsty and Abby as well, if you have anything to share on what's available for patients now, please could you contribute? Thank you.
Sure. I'll quickly pop in and just obviously say that your main port of contact once you have a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer is, of course, the lovely Abby and her counterparts across wherever you are. And that would be your clinical nurse specialist. And obviously, I'll let them talk about what they have available in their local hospitals. But as a charity, we do provide support and information for people who have been newly diagnosed and also their family members and anybody who's been affected by pancreatic cancer in any way, actually. We do run a series of webinars, and those are available online. The ones that have been done are already available to watch back. We have online support sessions, which we have available for anyone affected, and these are run over Zoom. And also we have support sessions for people who are looking after those who are diagnosed, just so that people can share openly. We have obviously our support services, which is our online phone and email service, where you can speak to one of our 7 clinical nurse specialists. And we also have free publications, which you can order to be sent or you can download. And we have a lot of information on our website as well, including real life stories and our latest tool to help patients with pancreatic cancer is our Medley app. So if you're technologically minded and you enjoy using apps to track things like your treatments and medications and things like that, those are available as well. And I'll hand over to some of the others now who can explain what they have in their own local area.
Thanks, Jenny. Really appreciate that. So I'll just mention about what we do with CNS's at Addenbrookes for our patients. So once patients have been in clinic, they can go to our cancer support service, which is located just by our outpatient centre. And they're really good at referrals to otherwise organisations or just offering a listening ear. they're really good for things like financial support, practical support, and even just emotional support as well. And we're rolling out in Addenbrookes here. We're employing a cancer navigator for a holistic needs assessment, which patients can have done at the beginning of treatment, during their treatment or after their treatment. And it just helps the patient and us get to grips with how they're going to manage their cancer journey, if there's anything we can do to benefit them and make it a better experience for them. And lastly, when patients have finished treatment, we are doing something called a patient-initiated follow-up, which is where patients can contact us if they've got a new symptom or they feel that they've got an individual need that needs following up post-treatment. So I think that would be really beneficial for our patients, knowing that they've always got a contact back to us. And I always say, if patients are at home or there's a relative at home that has a concern and they feel they need to speak to someone but they're not sure who, always give their CNS a call. We can be a first port of call to divert to anyone else that may need it. But yeah, so I'll pass over to Kirsty.
Thanks very much. Well, we offer a drop-in service at Maggie's. We're here Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. And I'm one of a member of a small team of cancer support specialists, and we work quite closely with Addenbrookes, and we get referrals from the navigators. So we provide psychological and emotional support, and that's not only the patient, but anybody else surrounding that patient, so family, friends. We also offer appointments one-to-one, and we can refer to our psychologists or to any of the group sessions that we feel might be appropriate. And that's for forever, really. It's from pre-diagnosis through treatment to post-diagnosis and to the end, really. So there's no time limit on our support. But it certainly sounds like there's quite a rounded amount of support. And I quite often signpost to Pancreatic UK, Cancer UK, because you have such a lot of information on your website. So that's a great support too.
That's lovely. Thank you. Asa from Cambridge asks, what support are patients in receipt of after diagnosis, follow-up and post-treatment? I think that's fairly much covered it, but is there anything else anybody wants to say quickly on that? Nope. Otherwise, we will press on. One of the most difficult symptoms and uncomfortable, potentially embarrassing, and the symptoms to deal with are the digestive system symptoms. So we're looking at the diet and things that are available to help with that. So Laura, this is very much the ball in your court here. If we could talk about that and perhaps touch on type 3C diabetes as well, which some of us are lucky enough to have along with everything else. Thank you.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about and deal with, isn't there, when you've got pancreatic cancer in relation to your diet. And that's mainly because of the role of what the pancreas does in your body. And most of us, if your pancreas is working well, it's not something you ever think about. It's sort of buried right there in the middle of your abdomen. But it gets on with a lot when it's not doing it, and you need to intervene a bit more. That it's a lot to deal with. So one of the main roles of the pancreas is involved in digestion. So it produces digestive juices. So you eat your food, it goes down into your stomach, and when it comes out of the stomach, your pancreas sends these digestive juices into your bowel to break down what you've eaten so you can absorb it further on in your bowel. So if either the pancreas isn't able to produce enough of these digestive juices, which contain these enzymes that do the digestion, or they're blocked from a tumour from getting into the bowel, then you can't fully digest what you've eaten, and some of what you've eaten stays in your bowel, and then you pass it down the pan. So that means, one, you're not nourished by it because it stays in that tube and is passed out, and two, you can get these symptoms, which Sally alluded to. So people can get wind and bloating and a change in bowel habit, which can be difficult to manage. But there is something we can do about it. We can. There are companies that produce these digestive enzymes. They come from pig pancreases. and you can take them in a capsule when you eat to help you to digest your food. It's something that people take every time, or almost every time they eat or have a milky drink. And the number that people take will vary from person to person and will vary depending on how much people are eating. So as dietitians, that would be one of our first goals, would be to help people to be able to digest and absorb the nutrition that they are having. They are all produced as a byproduct from the meat industry, from pig pancreases. Internationally, there are no alternatives. So we have a letter from an imam and a rabbi to say that because there's no alternatives, they are supportive of people taking these. But people need to know that that's where they come from and make their own decisions and maybe talk to their own family or spiritual leaders. So that would be our first aim, to help people to digest and absorb the nutrition they are having. When some people struggle to eat more, there's a lot of things that make it challenging to get the nutrition that you need. When you've got pancreatic cancer, you can feel tired, you can feel nauseous. It can be difficult to stand up, to prepare the food, to eat the food, to swallow the food, all sorts of different challenges. So we would look through whatever someone's individual situation is and what we can do to help to support them to overcome those challenges, to get a bit more nutrition, if that's what they need at the time. And we'd also talk a little bit about activity. The physios are the experts there, but we would talk in, you know, even if you've got all the nutrition you needed, but you were not moving, then you are going to, your muscles are going to become less strong. So we would be discussing that with people as well. And then Sally mentioned type 3C diabetes. So more and more people are getting to hear of the term 3C diabetes now, which is wonderful. If you haven't heard of it, then there are the types of diabetes most people hear about are type 1 and type 2. There are actually, if you break it down, hundreds of different types. But type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition, which means that the beta cells in your pancreas aren't producing as many of the are producing the insulin that they would usually produce, because I mentioned that the digestive juices is one of the big roles of the pancreas, and the other one is producing the hormones that regulate the level of glucose, which is a sugar in your blood. So if you don't have enough of those to produce the insulin, then it's harder to get the right level of glucose of the sugar in your blood. And then the type 2 diabetes is more of a metabolic condition, and that's where your body is not responding to the insulin that you're producing in the way that you'd want it to. And type 3C diabetes is more like type 1, but it's not quite the same. And that is when you have it caused by some sort of damage to your pancreas, which could be pancreatic cancer, and it runs concurrently with the digestive, not producing the digestive juices at the same time. And that you should be managed by a specialist diabetes team or a specialist, you know, through your GP surgery to manage the right type, the right treatment. So 80% of the people in the UK that have diabetes have type 2 diabetes. So a lot of the information you find online is for people who've got type 2 diabetes. And that is a lot about weight reduction, reducing the fat in your diet and things, and that's not appropriate for most people with pancreatic cancer. So it can be a bit confusing. We have information sheets that can be supportive for people to read, and also for their healthcare professionals if that's helpful. Did I cover the questions you had?
Yes, I think from a aspect, at the moment there's not great understanding or knowledge about diabetes in the community, which I agree with. And actually, in terms of resources for the community and for people caring for patients, even clinicians, because a lot of clinicians don't know this term, I'd have to say, you know, I'm kind of interested in what resources there might be in the community. And I know that Jenny, there are some webinars from PCUK recently. And, you know, if this is something which looks like it might be of interest, we could arrange a dedicated podcast or something with the experts. And so I don't know, Jenny, whether you wanted to say anything about that.
Yeah, I think we speak to people from all over the country, and we invariably hear, I've been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, or so-and-so has never heard of type 3C diabetes, or they don't know how to manage it, or it's not being managed properly, or things are swinging, you know, so that they're not stable. So I think it, I would agree with Laura, it is a really specialized subject, and it's not something that you can just treat as a type 2 or type 1 diabetes. It has a specific way of treatment, and you have to take into account the fact of the weight loss as well in the backdrop of that. And so having a type of program for type 2 diabetes is not going to work in the pancreatic cancer patients. So I think it is a concerted effort. It is good that people are a bit more aware, but I think there is more to be done in terms of raising awareness, and we're very conscious of that, and we always refer patients to their pancreatic specialist dietitians. There aren't enough of them to go around, of course, so we try to plug little gaps, but we always refer back because we feel quite passionately that this needs to be treated correctly. And we do have webinars which are on our website. They're already pre-recorded, but yes, keep plugging and keep highlighting that it is different and it needs to be treated differently.
Jenny, and I saw Yvonne did have a hand up. I thought that was
yes, I think kind of just wanting to join in with this acknowledgement of the difficulty of symptoms that come alongside pancreatic cancer, and particularly fatigue. And this is what our service, I'm kind of flying the flag for my occupational therapist colleague here, who will do bespoke fatigue assessment and management and help people with self-help strategies to improve those symptoms. Some of the digestive symptoms of nausea we can help with alongside pain. And we know that the more difference we can make to people's quality of life and how they feel, the better they're able to tolerate their treatment.
I mean, that is quite relevant. I think in terms of the dietary and nutrition, the diabetes management, I think we've discussed about the diabetes and possibly about the enzymes. I'm guessing you have quite a lot of questions about that. And I'm sure, Sally, you come across this a lot of times, I think, in your patient groups.
Yes, I'm in contact with quite a few pancreatic patients through a Facebook page, and it's the perennial problem. And on the occasions that we do get to meet together, a lot revolves around the pancreatic enzymes and dealing with the toilet issues. You get to learn to discuss things with people that you've never met before that you would never normally do. But It's a huge issue. It's a very, very disabling issue for some people. Some people have to rush to the loo an awful lot and suffer a huge amount of discomfort, and getting the dose right takes a long time. It took me, for instance, several years to get my doses of pancreatic enzymes correct so that I was much more comfortable and much more pleasant to be around.
Sorry, Laura.
I was just going to add in there that I'm really feeling for those people that you're mentioning that are saying those things, and that I can't think of a patient where we didn't manage to make it better. So I would really say that if there is anyone who is still experiencing those symptoms and they're not in touch with their pancreatic cancer or HPB specialist dietitian, to get in touch with them, because even if it's years later, sometimes something changes. All of us, our pancreatic function declines as we go through our life. And so if you have less pancreas or something else going on, then you might notice those things earlier. And if you're getting those symptoms, do talk to us, because like I said, I can't think of anyone where we couldn't make a difference. And we would always look at the enzymes first, but there are other things that can give very similar symptoms to not having enough pancreatic enzymes. And so for those people, we would look at other causes and then we would treat those. So please don't suffer on your own. Reach out, and I hope we will be able to help you.
I can see that Kirsty's got her hand up there.
Yes, just very briefly picking up on Sally's comment about the toilet issues. Just a couple of things. I'm sure most people know this, but there is a Macmillan toilet card that people can get, which will make asking to go to the toilet when you're out in public spaces maybe a bit easier. And also, you know, we can't underestimate the confidence issues that come along with being outside, going and meeting friends. If you're worrying about going to the toilet, you know, that's a huge impact on people's confidence and impacts their sort of social life and just doing normal things. So just to sort of highlight that issue, really. Thanks.
I've got a question here from Nicola. Do you have to follow a specific diet, Laura? I'm guessing it's just different for different people, but can you advise what you usually say in terms of diet?
So, yeah, there isn't a specific pancreatic cancer diet. Some people are disappointed to hear that. I think they would like a diet to follow, and sometimes it's quite nice. It's something that you can do. But actually, so it is specific to individuals, but the general principles are that the body gets what it needs. And that's the same for everyone, whether you've got pancreatic cancer or not. And you need it in a reasonable balance. Excuse me. So if you're not able to eat very much, so your portion sizes are quite small and you're maybe not eating as frequently or you're having little and often, then it's really good to try and get as much protein and calories into the small portions as you can. So what is healthy and what is recommended for someone in that situation is going to be different from the healthy eating messages that are there for the general population. And some people can really understandably make different changes when they get a diagnosis of any type of cancer. They want to be really healthy and they want to do what they're supposed to do, and they want to do everything that's going to help them the most. And they've heard that you're supposed to have more fruit and veg and more fiber and those things. And therefore, in that sort of time of need, they follow that advice, which is totally understandable. But for someone who has got a low appetite and is struggling to eat very much, that's not always what's going to benefit them most in that situation. So we talk about no food is banned, lots of protein, lots of calories if your appetite's not great. If you're feeling well and you're eating normally, then it would be the same sort of healthy eating messages as the general population, making sure you get enough fruit, veg, enough of your vitamins, your minerals, your iron, your calcium, your protein and everything there. If you have diabetes and pancreatic cancer, then the recommendations are not as strict as they would be for a type 1, which actually is quite variable nowadays anyway. So it would often be to try and avoid sugary drinks and things like boiled sweets, where it's basically just sugar, but no other limits, unless it's a specific case and you're being well supported with that by a diabetes team.
Something I sometimes see in my oncology clinics is patients come up with this real wasting kind of, they're kind of losing a lot of weight. They're really struggling with their intake. They've got this phenomenon which we call cachexia, which is where they're losing their muscle mass and all sorts of unpleasant side effects associated with that. So they lose a lot of weight. And how do you advise that? Because sometimes it's really not easy to eat when you don't feel hungry.
It really is hard. That does depend a little bit on where someone is in their journey. Cachexia is a continuum. And this is why, as dietitians, we believe that we should meet people as early as we can in their journey. The earlier you can intervene and help with the supportive nutrition, the more difference you can make. If you get further down that, you get to what's called refractory cachexia, which is where you can't actually replete the muscle because of this metabolic response to the cancer that your body is delivering, which is quite prominent in pancreatic cancer. And there is a stage where actually what we need to do is accept that this is what's happening and it shouldn't be a battle. And it's really hard when it becomes a battle within a family, because it's so hard to see your loved one wasting. And food is a very loving, giving thing, and when someone doesn't want to eat the food, that's really hard. So sometimes it's about managing that, and managing that actually when someone comes to the end of their life, it's quite normal that they don't want to eat very much. And so it does depend a bit on where someone is in that pathway, but the little and often, sometimes having something like a nourishing soup or a homemade smoothie or something like that is easier to take than a meal. Sometimes it's over-facing to have a big portion on your plate, and so little bits are a bit easier to approach.
Jenny, I think you wanted to say something, didn't you, about, or are you going to, are you replying online to the question about minerals and vitamins?
I am indeed. I'm just
right. Sorry.
That's no problem.
Right. We will carry on then. So Aisha from Colchester has asked what surgical treatments are available for pancreatic cancer. And I think this one is very firmly your question, Asif, isn't it?
Thank you. Thank you, Sadie. Yeah, so important question. And this is something on the minds of lots of people, lots of patients that are diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So unfortunately, pancreatic cancer is still as a condition where vast majority of patients at the time of diagnosis are not resectable, which means that the cancer cannot be removed completely to allow them to have a chance of cure. But we do like to look at every single patient that is referred to us via our own center or the referring centers to assess and to push the boat and to give every patient a chance for that resection, that surgery to remove the cancer. But only a minority are able to do that. So the surgery, the resection surgery for cancer, it depends on basically three things. One is the staging of the pancreatic cancer. So the patient need to have a localized disease, as in the patient's cancer has to be within the pancreas or the very regional area. If there is any distant disease, which is called stage 4 disease, or surgery is not going to be possible. Within the regional disease, if the cancer is managed to involve major blood vessels, and there are lots of very important blood vessels around the pancreas. If they involve the major blood vessels around the pancreas, although sometimes surgery can be considered, but it's very challenging and often it's not possible. And the second aspect and the third aspect of this is that the patient needs to be fit enough. Pancreatic cancer surgery is a very major operation, typically an operation called Whipple's resection, which is to remove the top part of the pancreas, what's called the head of the pancreas. And take anything between 6 to 8 hours. Patient is in the anesthetic in the theater for the best part of the day. So they need to be strong enough. Of course, they should be willing enough to be able to do that. And then the third thing is the type of surgery is dependent on where the cancer is within the pancreas. If it is down towards the what's called the tail of body part of the pancreas, which is more towards the left side of the abdomen, then it is a relatively smaller operation called distal pancreatectomy, often combined with removal of spleen. But if it is in the top part of the pancreas called head of the pancreas, then it is an operation called Whipple's resection, as I mentioned, which is a much bigger operation. So we do assess every single patient, give the patient the best chance to have this what we call as curative intent surgery and to put them in the path for hopefully getting a cure or a long-term survival. But it all depends upon, as I said, these three things: the staging, the vascular involvement, the location, and of course patient's fitness.
Thank you, Asif. Coming on to the fitness, exercise is really important. I, before I had to retire on ill health grounds, was a physiotherapist and was able to do a lot of my own rehabilitation because I knew what I could do and what I couldn't do. But a lot of patients from my clinical experience are really frightened to move. They think that if they cough or move, their stitches are going to burst open. And that is most definitely not the case. You're wanting your patients to move, aren't you? And you know that your stitches are going to hold within reason, whatever they do, as long as they're not going off and going weightlifting or something. Is there anything else you want to say on that?
Yeah, no, I think this is a very important point, Sally. There is a strong data out there to say that people that are able to move or get out of bed and do things post-operatively and have that strength pre-operatively, as Laura has previously mentioned, so prehabilitation to try to make patients stronger in terms of diet and exercise, but also post-operatively, all the surgeons and the team looking after would want the patient to move about quickly. In form of enhanced recovery. And that is shown to be beneficial in terms of reducing the time the patients spend in the hospital. So getting back to normal lifestyle as soon as possible should be the key driver in the patient's minds, and of course, the people looking after that patient. So it's not sitting around on a sofa watching telly or lying in a bed all the time. And of course, a lot of patients are unable to do that for various reasons. But if they are capable, there should be nothing holding back. Pain is obviously a key issue, and fatigue. And a lot of these things could well be psychologically overcome to a degree. Patient, if they know that if moving from here to, you know, 10 yards going to the garden might be beneficial, and if the patient know that, they will push themselves to do that. So it is as much for the clinician to realize this, but also patients and their family to say, no, sitting around is not good. Moving around is better.
So in terms of the prehab, prehab and rehab, you know, I think it's all tied in, isn't it? It's, all of this is optimizing your kind of general functional status, your physical levels of fitness. And, you know, that clearly people like Laura and our physiotherapists and occupational therapists, and, you know, I'm sure have a huge role in this. And it's just whether you're accessing this, because this is stuff you can do without a prescription, potentially. You know, it's stuff you can go home and actually work on yourself. And I think that's really a positive thing for people to do. It would be, you know, really useful to kind of, I think there've been webinars, we've had some podcasts on that, which we should send some links to previously. Laura, you've taken part in some of those, haven't you, in terms of optimization of those aspects?
Yes, yeah. And just to say that I know we're talking about surgery now, but rehabilitation is also really beneficial for people who are having chemotherapy.
That is
true. And there's exercise during chemotherapy to whatever, you know, it goes in the cycle. Obviously, people have a few days where they don't feel so good, but this idea that we used to have, someone's not very well, they've got cancer, we must do everything for them and make every drink for them. And, you know, it is now outdated, and actually doing, it's lovely to feel emotionally cared for, and that's really important. But in terms of moving and making your own cup of tea, or I don't know, putting some things away at home, walking around the garden, these little bits of movement are really beneficial to try and not have long sedentary periods. Keep the muscles moving. It's easier to keep your strength than to lose it and regain it.
Maybe Jenny and Abby, is there anything else you recommend, you know, in terms of the non kind of medical or non-prescription sort of things to optimize aspects before surgery, after surgery, and you know, alongside chemo?
Well, I think psychological care is really important. You know, I think that we can underestimate the impact of such a diagnosis on somebody. And if they're fit to have surgery, it's fantastic. But sometimes they are in the operating theatre and finished before their sort of brain sort of processes the fact that they've had this massive diagnosis. So everything can move quickly, and then they sort of have this kind of realization of what's just happened to them. And so I think psychological preparation is really important. And I guess it's not probably something that is, you know, the first and foremost in people's minds, because people are so busy and time is so limited. So that's why it's important to have places like Maggie's and your clinical nurse specialist and your GP and other services such as ourselves to be able to tap into, to just kind of go through some of these things, and certainly to process some of the kind of big issues that kind of come on the back of that, where you may not have had that sort of impetus to do it prior to surgery. And I think it's important because it does help people to kind of recover. And I agree with what Laura was saying about just the small wins, just like little movements, little things that they're able to achieve, and to allow people to be independent as well, and not to take everything away from them just because they're not very well and that kind of thing, but to allow them to move at their own pace and to, you know, do things for themselves. And I'll hand over to Abby, because I'm sure she's got some top tips as well.
I just wanted to add, that's really good, Jenny. I just wanted to add about
family and relatives, I think supporting them through this as well. Their relative and loved ones have gone through big surgery and then coming to us for a chemotherapy treatment potentially. So I think making them fully aware of how their relative might be feeling and giving them support in speaking to each other and helping them discuss topics that can be quite tricky and quite emotional. So I think sort of engaging in that conversation with them, which we tend to do normally on the telephone, but referring back to PC UK and also over to Maggie's, I find really beneficial for patients.
That's lovely. Thank you. I think that's moving us on nicely to the next section, which is well-being for patients for whom surgery isn't an option and treatment and palliative care there. So Yvonne, would you like to say anything on that first of all, or one of others?
Yes, I'd love to. So palliative care is appropriate, the World Health Organization says, for anyone with a life-threatening illness, and pancreatic cancer would definitely fit that. And what we are starting to see from the research, and I posted a paper on the chat, is that early seeing of a palliative care specialist, either via an enhanced supportive care service such as the one I run, what we're aiming to do is to improve your quality of life in any way we can. And whether that's improving pain, nausea, constipation, depression, anxiety, fatigue, what we want to do is get you feeling as well as possible so that you're able to tolerate your treatment for as long as possible and so that your quality of life is as good as possible. And we want to support you and we want to support those close to you as much as we can.
In terms of specific kind of aspects, you know, so the things that commonly come across you, how would you say, what are your approaches to managing pain?
So kind of assessment is really vital. Kind of where is the pain? What brings it on? What makes it better? How is it characterized? What impact is it having on someone's life? What are they already doing for it? What's working? What isn't? And what we know with pancreatic cancer pain is often it's a kind of central abdominal pain that radiates to the back. It often does respond to opioids, so strong painkillers, and also medications that dampen down irritated nerves can also be really helpful. So those medications need to be used and escalated with really careful assessment of whether they're working and how much they're helping. Other interventions can involve injections near that site, which can either be done endoscopically or percutaneously, something called a celiac plexus neurolysis. And sometimes that can be really helpful, A, in helping with the pain, but also in reducing the amount of strong painkillers someone needs. Because obviously strong painkillers contribute to constipation, which if you're already feeling grotty, being very constipated is very much part of that. And laxatives are needed for anyone on strong painkillers, but often when painkillers are causing a constipation, you need a specific type of laxative to counteract that. And those are newer medications that are really helpful for maximizing quality of life. And we'd want to work with all the professionals based here to say, okay, the abdominal symptoms, how much of this is pain, how much of this is malabsorption, how much of this could be improved by doing things. And I think with pancreatic cancer, you make a small improvement in one area and it cascades. So you improve pain and you improve nausea. Someone can eat better, so therefore they sleep better, they're less tired, and that means the following day is just that bit easier.
And in terms of managing the fatigue, I mean, I guess some of the aspects might be similar to how you do prehab or rehab post surgery, for instance. So even in the more advanced setting, you know, how do you advise on managing that, you know, either at PC UK or Kirsty or yourself, Yvonne?
So I talked, I'm not a fatigue specialist, so often I'm very lucky to have access to physiotherapists and to occupational therapists who are brilliant at this. But I tend to do a kind of three P's, planning, prioritising and pacing. So say to people, okay, what's the most important thing for you to do? How can you plan to do it with conservation of your energy? And are there steps you can break it down to make it slightly easier for you? So for example, if you really want to go out and have a cup of tea with a friend, is there someone that can drop you there? Can you get a taxi home so that you can really enjoy that time with your friend? The other thing I tell people often if I'm seeing them when they're much less well is to say, having a shower is great, but not if it wipes you out for the rest of the morning. So have your shower, get someone to buy you. When they say, can I get you anything? Get the biggest bath towel you can and wrap yourself in it and lie down rather than towel drying. And that means you can enjoy the refreshing having of a shower without it wiping out the rest of your morning. Again, really simple, something simple that can often make quite a big difference.
Jenny?
I mean, I think we have to remember that the biggest proportion of patients who are diagnosed with pancreatic cancer will not get to surgery. So they will be going through the palliative route most of the time. And we think that enhanced supportive care or palliative care support should be started much earlier than it is currently being started. Because like Yvonne said, even by optimizing something in a small percentage, it makes such a big difference in so many other areas of their lives. And a lot of the questions that we deal with on support line are around symptom management. And so again, like, we'll either refer back to dietitians or clinical nurse specialists or GPs, but also if we can help, you know, to give suggestions as well, we will. But our big you know, noise that we want to make is that this needs to be started much earlier on in the journey. And so we're very keen that enhanced supportive care is a term that people are familiar with, because I think if you mention the word palliative to people, they can switch off because they think this is quite, you know, depressing or lacking in hope and that kind of title. They don't really want to kind of relate to. But if you say, you know, enhanced supportive care, which will be, you know, a team of people who will make try to make as much difference in your life in terms of the symptoms that you're experiencing to make your quality of life better so that you can do the things that you want to do and, you know, live better. And this is what we're talking about today, living with pancreatic cancer. So we're all for the enhanced supportive care teams. And we do believe that that is absolutely crucial for most of these patients who will not have surgery. So yeah, just wanted to say that.
Kirsty, was there anything you wanted to add at all?
Yes, I was going to say that Maggie's absolutely recognised the fatigue aspect of any cancer patient, but we run fatigue management workshops every other month, and that's supported by some physiotherapists in Edinburgh who come and do those Zoom sessions for us. So it is very sort of, it's a balance between managing sleep, diet and exercise, you know, all of which are clearly quite tricky and challenging for these patients. But yeah, I love that idea, Yvonne, of you saying about the shower, you know, how lovely that is to feel clean and fresh clothes on, but actually just to wrap yourself in a big towel. That's great. That's something I'll take away and maybe suggest. Thank you.
Abby, did you want to us to address any of this at all?
I don't think so. I think it's been covered. I think just letting patients know that they don't have to, I think sometimes they can sort of go overboard and think, I've got to finish all these jobs today, especially if they're living alone, they've got housework to do. I think it's, we often say, do something, have a rest. If you've got some hoovering to do, do some hoovering for 10 minutes and then have a bit of a rest, have a cup of tea, see how you're feeling, rather than thinking of what to all to do today and letting it build up, because I think that then affects their mental state and can bring them down quite a lot. So I always say little and often, and the same with food as well. If their appetite's quite poor, just trying things little and often as well.
It's also about learning to pace yourself, isn't it? And
yeah,
going with what you can do on the day. I mean, I can remember when I was on chemo after I had my secondaries, standing at the foot of my stairs and wondering how I was going to get up them, because you are just so fatigued. So you have to be realistic about what you can manage. And if you can't manage something very much that day, just getting up and dressed and showered, or the other way around probably, is going to be plenty. And if you can move a little bit during the day, then that's great. But if you can't, then at least you've achieved that.
Mm. And sometimes there are kind of big big events coming up, which you can kind of save your resources for. And, you know, so I think it's important to have those things on the horizon, that you've got things to look forward to. So, you know, if your treatment's happening in the background, that's not the focus of your life. The treatment's happening in the background so you can live your life. You know, it's very important that you have that sort of framework. And you have things to look forward to with your loved ones. I might just now introduce the last session, just because I think that there have been a few questions really about what the future might hold and how we might try and get early diagnosis, what might treatments involve. And maybe I'll ask Paolo just to kind of mention a few of his thoughts about where he feels we might be going in terms of trying to make better outcomes from the kind of treatment and identification part of side of things.
Well, I should say that the future lies on understanding how the pancreatic cancer begins. And it surely begins a lot of decades before the final disease we happen to acknowledge in the ward with the patient, with the audience and the pain and so forth. So if we are able to identify the subclinical, subcellular, submolecular determinants of the disease many years before, we surely can survey, made some surveillance to those patients based on image evaluation, repeated recurrently, like we do for breast cancer and like we do for other common cancers. And we certainly help to bring much more often diagnosis of stage one disease, which can be cured by surgery. And surely the odds of surviving a cancer will improve very much. So I will bet a lot on prevention, on surveillance of at-risk individuals, healthy individuals, to become under some kind of evaluation to boost the diagnosis of early cancers.
Thank you. And I kind of just, you know, it is so complex. I agree. Everyone, I think, I'm sure Asif agrees that the more we can identify before they've spread, if we can reset them, that would be how we make a real impact in this condition. Because by the time you come to me with my oncology hat on and the treatments, we're just trying to control it and stabilize it, maybe shrink it, but we're not likely to cure it. I'll say that word advisedly. We're not likely to cure it at that stage. And but you know, it's not like having a lump on your skin which you can see. And in early cancer, you don't have any symptoms at all. It's so deep. It can mimic so many other normal symptoms just from day to day life, indigestion and back pain, etc., tummy pain. You know, trying to identify those cases early is going to be, it is a huge challenge. And, you know, I know, I mean, maybe Asif could say, you know, you have to be pretty sure that you're going to have this potential cancer before you do a resection, because surgery itself is no easy, you know, it's not an easy thing. It creates quite a few impacts on the quality of life. I don't know, Asif, what you want to say about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think correct diagnosis is the bedrock here. We don't want to be performing such a big operation, potentially life-changing, life-threatening operation, for no good reason. So we, in Addenbrookes, and I think most part of the world, certainly in the UK, are doing lots of preoperative diagnosis by confirmation with biopsy. In our unit, well over 95% people are actually diagnosed preoperatively, so we have a correct diagnosis. But in the era where the biopsy wasn't possible, 1 in 10 people turned out to be not having pancreatic cancer and had the surgery. And I mean, that, you know, not having a pancreatic cancer, of course, is a blessing, but having had a surgery is not such a great thing. So we want to minimize the what we call as a negative resection rate, where the patient didn't really need the surgery in the first place. Of course, if there is a doubt and we cannot clarify that doubt, we would often go down the route of surgery in order to give that patient that benefit of the doubt. We don't want to leave a operable cancer untreated if there is any element of doubt. So preoperative diagnosis is vital.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes. And it's just trying to find out with the biomarkers, you know, what factors you can find, which don't mean that you have to go necessarily into the abdomen, maybe with a blood test, a stool test, a urine test, a blood, you know, saliva, who knows, you know, if you can find something which makes you more likely to have this and then kind of wind up the investigations accordingly and appropriately, because it's not going to be for everyone who's got diabetes, for instance, you know, it's not going to be feasible to do that. We've got to kind of direct our approaches, you know, according to risk, I suspect. So, but this is a really active area. I think there was another question, which was, you know, what was the future of pancreatic cancer treatment, so maybe the therapy side of things, you know, because we are aware that chemotherapy is very modest in its benefits, and we're trying to identify factors which mean some patients might have better benefits from some forms of chemotherapy. Why has Sally done so well? We still don't really know, but we'd love to find out, and we think we've got some clues, but we certainly don't know. What we're doing a little bit more frequently now is we're doing molecular sequencing to find out whether there are any genes or proteins which altered, and some of those might have an impact not only on the way that cancer develops but also on potential therapeutic angles, because there might be targeted drug options available for that. A lot of people ask me about immunotherapy. In general, immunotherapy doesn't work very well for pancreatic cancer for a number of reasons. It seems to be fairly resistant to immunotherapy unless you're in a specific group of patients where their molecular type suggests they will be responsive, but that's a very small group. So some of the approaches are more designed to find out what factors in the pancreatic cancer. Is it the cancer cell? Is it the surrounding cells within the, what we call the stroma, which is the surrounding environment, the stromal cells? Are there impacts that by targeting some of those, which might mean that your cancer cells are now more susceptible to therapeutic approaches such as immunotherapy? So this is a really active area of research. I would encourage everyone with this kind of condition, if you're well enough, to consider clinical trials. You know, this is the only way we're going to make differences, I think, and impacts in survival, because everything we've had, you know, to date, all the benefits have been as a result generally of clinical trials. And I think I would always encourage you to ask. And that will be my main summary, but before closing, because I think we are really at time to close. And thank you so much for all the questions. We've had lots of questions beforehand. I'm hoping you feel that the panelists have answered them. And if there are specific questions which you feel we haven't, we are very happy to answer them outside or even to consider dedicated podcasts after this. But I would really like to thank the audience for joining us today. We will record this. Thank all of the panelists. Everyone has made some great input, and I hope you've gained something from it. I would encourage all the attendees to take the post-event survey, and you can submit any follow-up questions or pancreatic cancer-related topics that you'd like us to address in the future. All the resources will be forwarded afterwards. We've sent lots of links. I really would love to say thank you to Hui Ling U, our program manager, who has and Reese, who have been in the background helping us set up this webinar. I hope you found it useful. And there will be several events today because it is World Pancreatic Cancer Day. I encourage you to find them and support everyone. But for now, I'll ask all our panelists to say goodbye and thank you very much. Bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. And to all those undergoing treatment, I wish you the very best.
Thank you for tuning in to our podcast. Don't forget that if you have a question that you would like us to answer in a future podcast episode, or if you have any ideas for topics that you would like us to discuss in a future series, please let us know by visiting our website at www.crukcambridgecentre.org.uk/podcast. See you in the next episode.